tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. A warning has been issued by Syria. Syria's foreign minister is warning that Saudi or other foreign troops entering his country will return home in wooden coffins, and he asserted that recent military advances put his government on track to end the five-year-old civil war. Walid Omar Alam's comments capped a week that saw the collapse of the latest UN-led Syria peace efforts and a Russian-backed Syrian government offensive near the city of Aleppo that sent thousands of residents fleeing toward Turkey. A Turkish official said Saturday that as many as 35,000 Syrians had massed along the closed border. Suleyman Topsiz, the governor of the border province of Kilis, said Turkey would send aid to the displaced but had no immediate plans to let them in. He said Turkey was prepared to open its gates in the event of an extraordinary crisis. That was in contrast to the words of Turkey's foreign minister Mevlut Cavusoglu at the European Union meeting in the Netherlands.
We still keep this open border policy for these people fleeing from the aggression of the regime, as well as airstrikes of Russia. And these people are fleeing from such acts. So we need to keep this open door policy for them.
Meanwhile, in Amsterdam, the EU foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, urged Turkey to open its borders to the Syrians and said the EU is providing aid to Ankara exactly for such purposes. She said the displaced are Syrians in need for international protection and that this was the message delivered during the meeting. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Authorities in Afghanistan said Saturday national security forces and U.S. drone strikes have jointly killed at least 28 Islamic State fighters in a restive eastern region bordering Pakistan. The overnight attacks happened in Achin and Batakot districts of the province of Nangarhar, according to local officials. Agents Chief Hajib Ghalib told VO8 that 16 Daesh militants were killed when missiles fired by unmanned American aircraft struck a vehicle and a gathering of the group in a remote part of the mountainous district. They identified the dead as Pakistani militants. Separately, provincial officials say Afghan security forces in the nearby Batakot district killed 12 IS fighters and wounded several others in overnight clashes. They say two civilians caught in the crossfire were also killed. Four-nation talks aimed at ending Afghanistan's 15-year war concluded Saturday with a call for direct negotiations between the government and the Taliban by the end of February. However, recent battle-failed advances by the insurgents could make it hard to coax them to the table. A one-page statement released at the end of the meeting, which was attended by representatives of Pakistan, Afghanistan, China, and the United States, said a roadmap for peace had been agreed upon. However, it offered no details on what incentives the government might offer the Taliban. A Somali official says a bomb blew a hole in a jetliner, killing one person and forcing the plane to make an emergency landing in Somalia's capital of Mogadishu Tuesday. Ali Jama Jangali, Somalia's transport minister, said at a press conference Saturday that investigators concluded that a bomb caused the hole and was intended to cause the Dubai-based Da'alo Airlines jet to crash. He said the findings are preliminary and the investigation continues. United Nations and human rights organizations are calling for a complete stop to the harmful practice of female genital mutilation, which affects millions of women and girls worldwide.
Women and girls have been subjected to female genital mutilation for millennia, with the earliest recorded excisions having been performed on Egyptian girls in 25 BC. Indeed, Egypt in the 21st century remains one of the countries where FGM is most frequently performed. A recent report by the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, finds at least 200 million girls and women alive today have undergone female genital mutilation in 30 countries.
Rescuers were searching late Saturday for more than 100 people still missing after a powerful shallow earthquake struck southern Taiwan before dawn, causing a high-rise residential building to collapse and killing at least 14 people. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga. Peter Clote is off today.
It is a violation of the human rights of girls and women and has no health benefits. It harms girls and women in many ways.
The United Nations and human rights organizations call for a complete stop to the harmful practice of female genital mutilation.
The closures of the two universities have been necessitated to save public property and safeguard the lives of our people.
In Zambia, the government closes down two state-funded universities following student protests demanding the administration increase the allowances.
We took the opportunity to sensitize our thoughts on the major problem we are facing, what the SU Sorati called a cancer. But the most difficult moment for me was the meeting I had with the families of the victims.
And the UN mission in the Central African Republic investigates the latest allegations of sexual abuse committed by peacekeepers serving there. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. The United Nations and human rights organizations are calling for a complete stop to the harmful practice of female circumcision, which affects millions of women and girls worldwide. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. The call for a global ban comes as the world commemorates the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation.
Women and girls have been subjected to female genital mutilation for millennia, with the earliest recorded excisions having been performed on Egyptian girls in 25 BC. Indeed, Egypt in the 21st century remains one of the countries where FGM is most frequently performed. A recent report by the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, finds at least 200 million girls and women alive today have undergone female genital mutilation in 30 countries. The study notes half of these so-called cuttings have occurred in three countries, Egypt, Ethiopia, and Indonesia. FGM is widely practiced in countries in Africa and the Middle East. Tarek Shazarevich, spokesman for the World Health Organization, says the procedure involves partial or total removal of the external female genitalia or other injury to the female genital organs. He says there is no medical reason for this intervention.
It is a violation of the human rights of girls and women and has no health benefits. It harms girls and women in many ways. FGM is mostly carried out on young girls, sometimes between infancy and age 15.
FGM can cause severe bleeding, problems urinating, infections, as well as complications in childbirth and increased risk of newborn deaths. Some women and girls subjected to this procedure die. Many of those who survive suffer severe psychological consequences. There are cultural and social factors for performing FGM. A commonly cited reason is the need to prepare girls for adulthood and marriage by reducing their sexual desire to maintain their virginity before marriage and fidelity during marriage. There is no religious basis for this practice. Human rights expert Benyam Mesmore tells VOA a growing number of countries are passing laws criminalizing FGM, but their impact is limited.
Even though in the presence of laws, in some instances they are not explicit, in some instances even when they are explicit they are not enforced, and again traditional leaders, religious leaders also have a role to play.
UN agencies warn the overall rate of progress toward ending FGM is not enough to keep up with population growth. They say the number of girls and women subjected to this barbaric practice will increase significantly over the next 15 years if current trends continue. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zambia's information minister says the government has closed down two state-funded universities after students destroyed public and private property. They are demanding that the administration increase the allowances. The Copper Belt University and the University of Zambia in the capital Lusaka were closed down indefinitely after the government accused opposition party leaders of encouraging student leaders from the two institutions to create chaos. Information Minister Chisimbwa Kambwili told VOA's Peter Kilote that efforts by the government to resolve disagreements with the students have been undermined by some opposition leaders.
Yeah, the closures of the two universities have been necessitated to save public property and safeguard the lives of our people. You see, the politics in Africa are immature. The opposition political parties, knowing that we are now going towards elections, are taking money to bribe the students, to ask them to make protests so that the country can look as if it is ungovernable. And in this incident, the government just completed paying the students their meal allowances and accommodation allowances, and there was remaining to pay them project allowance and book allowance. So the students started protesting that government should pay them the project and book allowance immediately. Now, you know for sure that Zambia runs a mono economy, and at the moment, the collection of taxes from business houses has gone down since the price of copper plummeted, and that we have a bit of a challenge in terms of collection of revenue. So government said they were going to pay them the project allowances after about 2 weeks, but the students did not accept that. And what they did now, they went onto public roads and started stoning and damaging private individuals' vehicles. They became rioters and endangered the lives of our people. So government had no option but to close the two universities until further notice.
Do you have evidence of the accusation you're making that these opposition leaders or parties bribed these students to cause such chaos?
We have evidence. You know, in all the universities, we've got the intelligence system and we've got students who appreciate the ruling party and the lecturers who are pro-ruling party, and they've given us the information that some opposition political parties are behind sponsoring students to do this criminal and riotous behavior.
Will the government meet some of these student leaders to try to hash out some of these disagreements in order for them to go back to school?
We've had several meetings with the union leaders and the lecturers, and every time we have the meetings, we agree with the student leaders, but when they go back to campus, they do the opposite. We have tried to engage the students and their leaders. 2 days ago, I think 3 days ago, the Minister of Education went to address the students at the Copper Belt University. What did the students do? They walked out of the meeting. So as government, we've done our part. We've tried to engage them, but they've just become unruly.
Has the government taken a decision when it will decide to reopen the schools?
It must be noted that payment of bursaries by the government is not a right, but a privilege, because a lot of people want to enjoy these bursaries that the government gives or awards to some of the students. And I think by and large, what we are going to do is to screen these students, and those students that are advising other students to be rioters and to misbehave will be removed from the bursaries so that the bursaries can be given to genuine students who want to go to school. And I think by and large, we'll take action against student leaders that are feigning trouble in the universities so that those who genuinely want to learn can go back to school.
That was Chisimbwa Kabwili, Zambia's information minister. He spoke with my colleague, Peter Kilote. A new study shows the importance of developing roads, electrical grids, health clinics, and other forms of infrastructure in promoting development and reducing poverty. The survey by the polling firm Afrobarometer found that over 20 countries in Africa have improved economic growth and living conditions with active government support. From Washington, VOA's William Eagle reports.
The report shows that 22 out of the 33 countries surveyed showed impressive improvements in some of the so-called development infrastructure that lists living standards like food, clean water, cooking fuel, health care, and income. The study by the nonpartisan research network called Afrobarometer based its conclusions on interviews with nearly 53,000 people across Africa. Robert Matez is a senior advisor for the Africa-wide polling firm and a professor of political science at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. He says, in general, poverty levels are lower in urban areas and among those with secondary and post-secondary educations. But the survey shows that improvements, especially in rural areas and among those without education, depend to a large degree on government action.
Bill Clinton used to like to talk about giving people a hand up rather than a hand out. And, you know, you can see in many ways how this applies, because these aren't direct relief services to people. It's not providing them with food or government employment strategies. It's simply building things and building a road, a paved road, putting electricity in, putting a sewage network in. And people seem to be able to use that to get on with their lives in a much better way than where government hasn't done those basic things.
North African countries, many with authoritarian regimes, scored highest in the survey.
Yeah, we've only been conducting our surveys in North Africa in the past 4 years. But we were surprised when we started doing those surveys that the level of infrastructural development we found there was just substantially higher than anything we'd seen in southern, west, and eastern Africa in our previous surveys. So what is clear is the authoritarian regimes in those areas, one thing, and maybe simply as a means to stay in power, but they had invested quite a substantial share of their oil wealth into education. So people in North Africa tend to have far higher levels of schooling than people in sub-Saharan Africa, but also things like health clinics, things like sewage grids, electricity, etc.
In sub-Saharan countries, there were both successes and failures. Mozambique, Benin, and Liberia were among five countries with the largest increases in poverty, while five others surveyed showed no improvement. People in areas with conflict and health emergencies, such as Central and West Africa, reported having the most frequent shortages. On the other hand, several countries have shown an increase in living standards. Among them are Cape Verde, Zambia, and Ghana, countries that have used to their advantage the support of international funding sources like the Millennium Challenge Corporation. Matez says the three countries are the only ones to show a long-term trend in reducing poverty since 2002. Senegal, Namibia, South Africa, and Zimbabwe show decreases in poverty going back to 2008. Matez attributes the improvement in South Africa to its expansive social welfare network, which accounts for a large part of the budget. For many years, poor policy decisions and international sanctions contributed to increased poverty in Zimbabwe, which has been ruled for decades by the ZANU-PF party led by Robert Mugabe. But that changed with the four-year rule of a government of national unity that ended in 2013. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
The UN mission in the Central African Republic, MINUSCA, is investigating the latest allegations of sexual abuse committed by peacekeepers serving there. Mission Chief Ananga Anyanga on Thursday visited the town of Bambari, where seven new alleged victims have been located, most of them minors. UN Radio's Diane Penn asked Mr. Ananga Anyanga about his visit and the mission's efforts to tackle this problem.
We may just be seeing the tip of the iceberg. You must always remember that most of the areas that are really exposed to these crimes, areas where troops from earlier operations were rehated into MINUSCA. So we're talking about troops whose level of training, of, you know, the mindset, the whole background is totally far from understanding what it takes to be, you know, and to work in the UN.
And tell me, sir, in Bambari, what did you do?
Well, we did many things. Of course, as is the practice, we got a briefing from our people on the ground, our military, our security, but also our humanitarian colleagues. And from there, we went on to talk to first our troops, and we took the opportunity to sensitize our troops on the major problem we are facing, what the SU Sorati call a cancer. But the most difficult moment for me was the meeting I had with the families of the victims. And I have no words to really express my pain. In the local culture, men don't discuss these things. But they felt compelled to tell me the story of that poor woman who got gang raped as she was coming from fetching water and wood. That lady's life has been destroyed. The other thing that I learned also from the meeting with another group of community leaders, that underage kids, after having been raped and abused because they had to sell themselves for a living, they now have to go through the stigma of being expelled from families because nobody else is considering them as valuable. And this is, for me, the one thing that really hurt me and continues to do so. And therefore, I did two things with these community leaders. First, I take them to help us, to help them. That is to say, for now onwards, we want to be the UN that gives a voice to the voiceless. And this is not only a slogan, but we want to be the UN that breaks the silence and the time where troops would wrap themselves, you know, with the national flag and hope to walk away with murder. This time, I told them, is over.
Thank you so much for giving us all this information. I wonder if you could just remind our listeners what steps MINUSCA and the United Nations is taking to address sexual exploitation and abuse by peacekeepers.
Well, we're giving life to the SG's policy of zero tolerance. This is becoming the reality. We cannot live, we cannot rest until we have succeeded in getting, you know, rid of any offender in our midst. There will be no place for them to hide. So in concrete terms, in addition to ensuring that we can use the power that we have, that is to take administrative decisions to expel those who may be engaging in these activities, but we will not only expel, we will follow up. We will work more closely with countries to ensure that, you know, a crime committed abroad is a crime committed at home. Because this is about, you know, underage kids, and any kind of these acts are simply not acceptable.
That was Pafa Onanga-Nyanga, UN Special Representative and head of the UN Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in the Central African Republic. He spoke with UN Radio's Diane Penn. Meanwhile, in South Africa, a new generation of farmers is rising. They are committed to producing high-quality food, free of unnatural ingredients. Many of them are women. At the heart of this movement is demand from consumers for healthy food that isn't mass-produced with the help of chemicals and other artificial agents. In this first part of a series on South Africa's new wave of ethical farmers, Darren Taylor reports for VOA on a producer winning praise for her excellent chicken.
Fresh spring water nourishes New Harmony Farm north of Johannesburg in the shadow of the Magaliesberg Mountains. Farmer Ruth Mulroy says when she bought the land almost 6 years ago, it was filthy with scrap metal and overgrown with weeds. Now it's producing some of the best chicken in South Africa.
And I've just learned more and more as to what people shouldn't be doing. I know what I don't like, and I know what I do like, and I want to be ethically sound. I want my chickens to grow up as naturally as possible, to eat a natural diet as possible.
Mulroy says chickens have fascinated her since she was a child.
Gawk, 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 all the time. They're talking to each other. There's an interaction going on all the time. It's the communicating of I'm wanting to lay an egg, or with all the cackling when I've laid an egg. All of those, to me, are incredibly peaceful, natural sounds. I love them. I've always been a chicken lady. My nickname is Chicken Lady.
Milroy describes her chicken as naturally grown, in contrast to factory-farmed birds locked in cages their entire lives and overfed to bulk them up for slaughter. She says her birds live happily.
They don't live under artificial light. They've got to go to bed and sleep with the sunset, and they can get up with the sunrise. They get exposed to the outdoors as quickly as they possibly can. All those noises they're making, they're saying, we want to lay eggs, we want to lay eggs.
Milroy ensures her 600 chickens are clean and healthy. Inside her barns, there's no pungent stink of chicken feces mixed with chemical cleaning agents. The farmer says this is because she lines the floors with sunflower husk.
It dries out the feces. There's no buildup of wet feces. The houses stay clean, they stay dry, free of flies. We put it into their food as well, so it keeps them clean, so we don't have a problem with worms, internal parasites.
Chickens caged in their thousands on commercial farms are often surprisingly quiet, but New Harmony Farm chickens are very noisy.
They're active, they're running around, they all paw out in the morning, run around catching insects, grubbing around the place.
Milroy doesn't feed her chickens artificial growth stimulants and fish meal. Crucially, says the farmer, they eat natural food.
5 different indigenous grasses that I'm planting, but then barley in the wintertime, spinach, rape, kale, all are extra feed for the chickens that's planted that they get to eat off the land.
She says her chickens taste so good because of their diet and because they roam the land, so they're not fat. Also, their meat is denser because there's no water injected into it to increase the weight sold to make more money.
The meat is a lot darker, so it's not pale. It's a good old taste of chicken again. Chicken these days has got no taste to it. The youth of today, when they eat chicken, it's bland and tasteless. When they start to eat my chicken, they say, oh no, it tastes too much like chicken, because they're not used to chicken.
Nevertheless, Milroy's chicken is much in demand in Johannesburg. She supplies delis and restaurants specializing in high quality fresh produce. One such place is the service station. Here, New Harmony chickens are always on the grill. Manager Lo Kotzer says he buys Milroy's chickens because they're simply the best.
All the feedback we get is very positive. The cooking times on the chicken is a bit longer because it's free range. But yeah, if you cook it for about an hour and a half, hour and 3/4, you get a very tasty meal.
Milroy doesn't employ any laborers. The only help she gets is from her 2 young sons. The 3 live alone on the land. Risky in South Africa, where stock theft is rampant and criminals often murder farmers. But Milroy insists she doesn't feel threatened.
Our biggest enemy on this property is a honey badger and wildcats, because that is a problem. We have to lock all the birds up at night because of the wildlife, not because of the human factor.
Another looming challenge for her business is the possible closure of a local abattoir.
The last time we had an abattoir here that was close by, when that abattoir closed down, 19 small farmers shut down as a result of that because they couldn't afford to go further away. In this country, I don't think that we are encouraged as small farmers to survive. Who's there to back us up? If something goes wrong, I'm screwed.
South Africa's government doesn't subsidize small food producers like in some other countries. Every year, many go bankrupt because of drought and other factors, and food is lost to the country. But Ruth Milroy says she's determined to continue producing top-quality natural chicken without compromising her ethics. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Magaliesburg, South Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. Then we'll have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Yes, yes, yes. It's that time of Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening in Africa when we bring you our Saturday Music Spot. Just sit down, relax, and enjoy this music.
See, the whole world is looking at us. Yeah, cause our land is honey, all the future money. And see na, see akijima. No, no, I see lali. See atandi mali, they want it, yo. They need it, ah man, we have it, yes. Let the world come and taste this beautiful land. They want it, oh, they need it, yeah. We have it, let the world come and taste this beautiful land.
No.
Brothers and your friends, let's get together, let's hold hands and let us dance. Let's unite and give ourselves another chance. I see the waka follow the good thing, many things, everything the apple pick in the jolly. Oh yeah, now let's Africa be good. I need the sun or the rain or the sweet and the pain, we still get together, be good. Let's Africa be good. Oh, Nelson Mandela, Lupita Nyong'o. Desmond Tutu,
Africa.
Oh, Barack Obama, Kwame Nkrumah, all my freedom fighters.
Yeah. You know what time it is. Let's go, come on. Africa, stand up. Everybody move, make a decision, hands up. We came a long way, so now we can't stop. Free for life, we're taking off the handcuff. We came to spread love. The sea breeze, not so, Mama Africa, we need peace. Home sweet home, everybody will feel free. Check my people and check the beauty. Be my duty, they're trying to make it a better place for us. And I believe it's gonna happen in God we trust. Straight from the bottom all the way up to top. I prophesy, it shall come to pass. Amen. From dust to grass, from grass to grace. But it's left to us to make it happen on a daily basis. Back to back, Africa stand for peace.
Asante nyerere baba, inajivunia upendo wetu na amani. Tena pia Mugabe bendera baba, tunajivunia upendo wetu na amani. Tumejali mengi kutelo mengi omajeni melema mbuga pampiga yetu. Tazama mengi omselo mengi omito melema mbuga pampiga yetu.
Yeah. say that's in love. How you lose so much? How about your body, they make you the dance.
We no gon' break up. Say we no gon' break up. Yeah. We no gon' break up. Say we no gon' break up.
See, now you, they make my head, they go. Kolongo, eh.
Kolongo, eh.
And I just, they love your body, so. Alango, eh.
Alango, eh.
And my heart and soul is all for you, my baby, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let you know that I do
That music by David Adedeji, Davido, brings us to the end of our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Here is Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. This week, on The Voice of America, I like to highlight two or three issues with regard to U.S. policy on Africa. The President of the United States is grappling with big issues relating to the Iran issue. That's a major accomplishment of his administration with regard to relationship between America and Iran, America and the Middle East, and America and the world. The Iran peace treaty is not universally accepted by some of the political leaders in the U.S. or even overseas for a variety of reasons. This Iran deal also has consequences for Africa because the African governments were very much involved in the Arab-Israeli conflict, and that affected American policy. All the scholars, journalists, broadcasters, bloggers, and others who look at America and the Middle East, it has always been the Arab-Israeli conflict, which has gone through many transformations from the 40s, before the independence of African countries. All these narratives went back to the establishment of the State of Israel in the Middle East and the diplomacy between the European countries, France and England, and the implication of their relationship with the Arab countries, Israel and Africa. Today, the big issue is not the Arab-Israeli conflict. For the Arab countries, which are going through some serious transformation, to the point that the Iran-American deal is more important for many of the Gulf countries than some of the other Arab countries, starting from Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, all the water. The crisis of the Arab Spring and the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Iran deal makes these three issues very critical for American policy and Africa. Because when the Arab Spring occurred, many people thought that there was going to be a political hamatan, that was a metaphor I used at that time, that was going to sweep across the Sahara into Africa. Of course, the Arab Spring did not trigger a parallel African spring part of the Sahara. The Iran deal is going to have consequences also for Africa with regard to American policy towards Africa and African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. And that's one of the reasons why African leaders who are going to visit the United States are going to be caught up with internal African issues. How can law and order, state building and nation building take place in Africa? Of course, these three processes occur during the Arab-Israeli conflict. And that's one reason why you go back to square one. You go back to look at African state building and African diplomacy going back to Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana. Because when Ghana became independent in 1957, it was immediately caught up in the Arab-Israeli conflict. And when the story is told fully and truthfully, you can see the contemporary American-Iranian relations, which was very marginal at the time when Kwame Nkrumah was leaving Ghana and the Africans were confronting the Arab-Israeli conflict. Golda Meir was the first woman politician in Israel whose claim to fame came when he attended a conference in Accra with Kwame Nkrumah, allowing people like Tom Mboya, who were nationalists trying to be independent, and they welcomed Golda Meir. And that was the root cause of the rivalry between the Arabs and the Israelis. When Golda Meir came down there, soon after, Nkrumah was very much involved with the Egyptians, and the children of Kwame Nkrumah came out of that narrative. Because when you look at the history of Nkrumah and the Arab-Israeli conflict, you can see the history of the relationship going back to the United States, because the relationship between the Israelis and the Arabs and the Arab-Israeli conflict and consequences for Africa have serious consequences for U.S. policy and Africa. So all these African politicians who are talking about political stability in Central Africa, they cannot forget the fact that their mineral resources, their peoples going through the Middle East or Europe are all connected to American policy towards their country. That's the way it is today, as I see it.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, we thank you for joining us tonight and hope to see you again tomorrow Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The battle to discover the truth and the freedom to tell it is being waged every day by countless journalists around the globe. In a recent speech on press freedom, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry noted that last year, 71 media workers were killed while on duty, and almost 200 were thrown into jail. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Iraq and Syria are first and second on the list of deadliest countries for journalists, with 173 and 93 deaths, respectively, since 1992. Today, roughly two-thirds of the reporters who die violently are killed not in spite of their profession, but because of it. And they are attacked for what they have written, silenced for what they have witnessed, or kidnapped for the leverage that their capture might provide. And in most cases, the perpetrators are never caught. The truth is that independent media, reporters, broadcasters, photographers, bloggers, even cartoonists, are under constant pressure today, whether physical or political. It is now the 21st century, and yet only about one person in six lives in a country where the press can truly be described as free. So it is up to the defenders of liberty to close ranks, said Secretary Kerry. And this begins with the recognition that no government can fairly call itself great if its citizens are not allowed to say what they believe or are denied the right to learn about events and decisions that affect their lives. To those who try to intimidate or imprison reporters, said Secretary Kerry, we need to stand up and say loud and clear that committing journalism, reporting on the truth, is not a crime. It is a badge of honor. It is a public service.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.